Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guests are the authors of This Will Not Pass, New York Times political correspondents Jonathan Martin and Alexander Burns. Remember, we love to take your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @politicon for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. And please check out the links to this week's sponsors, Raycon and Chili Sleep, in the show notes. We thank you for supporting our sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. All right, James, this is a big week for us. There were five primaries yesterday, 2 huge ones. And to coin that old Hackney cliche, it's the 4th of July, and we sell firecrackers for a living. So let's get at it. Let's start with Pennsylvania. That's the biggest one. John Fetterman, the Democratic candidate, just blew out his opponent, Connor Lamb. He won every single county. He ran up a huge vote, despite the fact that he suffered a stroke, apparently a mild stroke, 4 days before the election. On the Republican side, it's still out there. Dr. Oz, the celebrity, I don't know what you call him, phony medical peddling doctor on television, and David McCormick, the billionaire hedge fund guy who was so friendly with China, are in a dead tie. The woman that we were all looking at, Kathy Barnett, she proved she wasn't ready for the Kentucky Derby. She was no Rich Strike. She kind of faded at the end. That Republican contest will go to a recount, and it may be weeks or even months before it's settled, because these two rich guys, neither one's going to give up easily. And James, I'll just say finally in this, I thought, and I said before I wrote, that I thought Fetterman was probably an underdog in a general election. He's different. 6'8", tattooed, campaigns and a gym short and a hoodie. He just didn't seem to me the type that was going to be able to win statewide. I've changed my mind. I think it's at least a toss-up for 3 reasons. Number one, the Republicans nominated a guy named Doug Mastriano, who is the fringe of the fringe. He was down at the Capitol on January 6th last year. He's a stolen election guy. He really is he's a nutcase. And I think a second reason I think the abortion issue is going to help Fetterman, in large part because Fetterman believes in pro-choice, and McCormick and Oz will just go through the motions of being anti-abortion. And finally, James, there is some advantages to being old. Back when you were in, I guess, probably a freshman or sophomore in college, I was an intern for the Philadelphia Bulletin, and there was a Democratic primary for the Senate. Genevieve Blatt and Michael Musmano, and I covered part of it at City Hall. It stretched out into the end of August, and it enabled Hugh Scott, the senator, to win in the general election, even though Lyndon Johnson was carrying the state huge. A protracted fight for that Republican nomination, Victor, has to help Fetterman.
Well, let me start out by saying I was publicly for Connell Lamb. My reason was very upfront about it, as I thought he'd be the best general election candidate. Last night, I volunteered to head up the Louisianans for Fetterman chapter. I'm totally aboard. I think that Fetterman has proved to be obviously a lot stronger candidate than I thought. There's a couple of things here, and I'm not being Pollyanna at all, but there are a couple of things here that we should consider. One is just what you said. They have a disaster for a gubernatorial candidate. Now, think about this, if you're just projecting forward, they're gonna, whether it's McCormick or Oz, I don't know, and we got a lot of counting left to do, they're both first-time candidates. They're gonna have to negotiate how they talk about Mastriano. Do they appear at events with him, because you know, Mastriano might be deadly on the main line. He might be deadly in Allegheny suburbs, you know, and places like that. But neither one of these guys has a relationship with that Trump base like Mastriano does. So if they diss him, they run into enthusiasm problems, they run into turnout problems, a lot of things. This is what you would call, what our friend Ed Luce would call, a sticky wicket. The other thing, you know, in addition to Fetterman being, you know, stronger than I or other people perceived him to be, you know, I thought, and I don't know what to read into it or not to read into it, but going into this election yesterday afternoon, I just kind of thought the Republicans would have much more higher turnout. They much higher turnout in Texas, much higher turnout in Ohio. I know they're different states, but it was, and you know, the truth of the matter is, without much of a primary and no gubernatorial primary, the Democrats were maybe 150,000 votes less than Republicans. I thought that was a very mild but positive sign. And they got a lot left before they even decide who their nominee is. They have a lot of negotiating to do with Mastriano. Fetterman thought a little head of steam. Whatever I thought our chances were in Pennsylvania yesterday afternoon, I think they're somewhat better this morning. And I mean that. It's not to say we don't have problems and the wrong track number and inflation and everything else. But sometimes, what I've noticed about Democrats and sometimes myself, I obsess so much on the problems we have, we forget about the other side. I did an event. And I said, you know, when I'm in my own huddle, I said, man, this is a pretty sorry lot. And when you go line up at the line of scrimmage, you go, well, they ain't got much either. So, I honestly believe that. I don't know if it's a 50-50 chance. If it's 50-50, it was 45-55 yesterday.
Yeah, I think it's at least 50-50. Now, right. James. Now, a couple things about Fetterman. First of all, you got to hope his health holds up. I mean, I've talked to some doctors who know a little bit about it, and they say that's, you know, what, how he had a pacemaker put in, that's really quite routine almost, it appears to be very mild, and he ought to be fine. One trouble spot, an otherwise fantastic night for him, there were some Philadelphia black wards where he ran really poorly. He finished third. There was a controversy about him at one point, which I think may have been overblown. He's got to make sure that he does well in that black community. So he's got some work cut out there.
He didn't work it very, I mean, maybe for whatever reason, but he didn't work it particularly hard. But he's going to have to get that vote unified come November. But I think they can. I know Malcolm Kenyatta slightly. But he strikes me as the kind of guy that understands what's at stake here. I'm sure Connor understands what's at stake here.
Well, Connor came out right away and said, you know, I'm all for John Fetterman. I'll campaign anywhere for him.
Good, good.
And I would guess Kenyatta will, too. I don't know what Kathy Barnett is going to say about either one.
She said she wouldn't endorse any of them, but
I mean, they really savaged her at the end. I'm not a Kathy Barnett fan, but the McCormick Super PAC and I think the Oz Super PAC actually put out blatant lies about her. They were so scared that she supported Black Lives Matter and defund the police, and it probably had some impact. I don't think she'd have won, but it'll be interesting to see what she does.
But the only good thing about them lying about each other is they're not lying about us.
James, let's turn to North Carolina, where the Trump-backed candidate, Congressman Ted Budd, a kind of obscure congressman, a gun owner, won huge over the former governor. Trump and the Club for Growth played a big factor there. The Democratic nominee is former Chief Justice Sherry Beasley. I want to immediately say that my son works for Chief Justice Beasley, so I'm gonna be a little bit tepid in my analysis of it. So why don't I just turn it over to you in North Carolina?
Okay. Well, you have to understand something, right? Bud has endorsed the Rick Scott plan, and Bud owes his victory to not only Trump but an outfit called the Club for Growth. All right. Now let me take 60 seconds to tell you about the Rick Scott plan. The Rick Scott plan says that everybody should pay federal income tax. The truth of the matter is people that make below a certain figure, and I'm sorry, I don't know it, but let's just say it's $50,000 a year, don't pay federal income tax. However, they pay payroll taxes, sales taxes, property taxes, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, their next dollar of income is taxed higher than Warren Buffett's next dollar of income. And so what Rick Scott, one of Rick Scott's proposals is everybody has to pay federal income tax. So that means that you're a parking lot attendant, you're an agriculture worker, you're a home health care worker, you're a waiter, you're a hotel maid. I could go on and on. What good does it do? Your taxes are going to go up by more than a little bit. The second thing that's in the Rick Scott plan, not discussed enough, but I'm sure it'll get some airing during the general election in North Carolina, is he calls for sunsetting, a vote to sunset Social Security and Medicare every 5 years. And if you don't think that they're going to do that, look what they tried to do in 2005 when Bush tried to privatize large parts of Social Security. Big sticking point in the late 90s with Newt Gingrich and President Clinton is they wanted to privatize huge parts of Medicare, of which they were famously defeated, but their intent was right there. And when you talk about the tax on people that make under $50,000 a year, remember in 2012 at the high-end event in Palm Beach when Mitt Romney was talking about the 47%? That's exactly what he was saying. Exactly what he was saying. Rick Scott doles out more money than anybody, but the kind of money that you want. It's something called, and I'm going to be a little complicated here, but I think it's worth engaging our listeners on this. There's something called 441 AD money, which means that the campaign, in addition to what they raise, with the limits that you have, can get from the Senate committees eligible for a set amount of money. In North Carolina, my guess is it's probably $1 million, a little bit more than that, but that money is three times more valuable than dog money or PAC money because the campaign can do with it whatever it wants.
Right, they control it.
That's golden money, man. All right, I would take a dollar of that for $3 of some third-party group spending money on behalf of my candidate. So this is regarding, and of course, you know, people say, well, it's just Rick Scott's idea, and, you know, McConnell says we're not going to do it. Well, that's it. So McConnell tells the Washington Post. The Washington Post says, well, McConnell said it. I believe it. That settles it. Who is going to believe Mitch McConnell other than the Washington Post? Nobody. And this is a Club for Growth is locked into this. That's all they're about. You know this. You worked at the Wall Street Journal for a long time. They've been carping about this for decades, about the people in the wagon or out pulling the wagon or makers or takers. They're specifically addressing the fact that they don't think a hotel maid pays enough taxes and a billionaire pays too much. That's exactly what they're saying. Right. And they can put all the cover up they want. If you've been around this business any length of time, of which unfortunately we both have, you even longer than me, you know that this is something that they've been talking about forever. This is not a new idea. And this is one of the worst ideas in the history of modern American politics. It doesn't come up to replacement theory, but it's pretty bad.
And sunsetting Social Security and Medicare.
Yeah, every 5 years.
I mean,
so you just wait till you get a Republican president, Republican Congress, and that's the end of Social Security. Goodbye. Thank you. Out of here.
Right, right. And I think it should be suicidal if it's handled right. You know, there were some other. I mean, do you have anything else to say about the North Carolina race, James?
To the extent that you get 80%, and of course you got that Madison Cawthorn thing, which I'm not overly delighted about. I thought he was a sufficient clown that he gave me some pleasure in life, and whoever replaces him, it's not going to vote any difference.
Oh, but James, don't worry. There are plenty of fill-ins for a Madison Cawthorn in that House Republican.
Yeah, well, I hope he gets a form.
I don't want you to worry. I think he's sick. I hope he gets some help.
I do too.
Right.
You know, he's just too young and too stupid.
Yeah.
And showed himself. Let me
turn to some others. First of all, I'm going to give credit to Ann Shields on this. Ann Shields made a comment about a couple of weeks ago. You know, Trump has considerable clout in Republican Senate primaries, but a lot less clout in Republican gubernatorial primaries. Because when you vote for governor, you know, you're not thinking about, you know, all of his crazy ideas. It's, you know, what I want, you know, in my state. I think that may be true. You know, he didn't like DeWine. DeWine won in Ohio. He endorsed Mastriano at the very end of Pennsylvania. It didn't have any impact. He's going to lose in Georgia next week. And he lost badly in Idaho yesterday. And conversely, North Carolina, Ohio, maybe Pennsylvania, Georgia, where Herschel Walker cleared the field, he has a lot more clout in Senate races. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I'm going to take a little issue with what my dear friend Ann Shields, and by way of husband Mark, is a very close friend of Al and mine, and also for a long period of time. So, yes, Trump endorsed J.D. Vance, and J.D. Vance won the Ohio Republican primary.
Right.
Yes, Trump endorsed Dr. Oz, who I don't know, it's 55-45 that he wins this, or, you know, they still count votes. But if he's such an all-powerful, all-compassing figure in Republican primaries, both of them got 32%.
Yeah.
Which you can say that they wouldn't have been there without Trump. They'd obviously, J.D. Vance would not have won the nomination and been a Trump endorsement. Obviously, Oz would have lost to McCormick without the Trump endorsement. But 68% of the Republicans in Ohio and Pennsylvania, and it's a staggeringly stable number, went somewhere else.
That's true. Yeah.
I mean, James, Ann is right. Brad Little just crushed that person endorsed out in Idaho. You know, Mastriano won, but he did that to kind of save face. He couldn't beat DeWine. I mean, there's legitimacy to what Ann says, but I think she might overestimate.
No. Let me quickly. I think I may have slightly misrepresented. She was just talking about governor's races. And just saying,
It's a legitimate point to say they pay more attention to him in Senate than governor's races.
Right,
but
right.
They're not a third of them.
Yeah, he's not winning governor's races.
No, and he's not chalking up any big wins in Senate primaries. If wherever he wins, he ekes it out.
Yeah. The next big Senate contest for him, James, is Missouri. There may be some before that, but that's a big one. He's endorsed this guy, Eric Greitens. Eric Greitens is a guy who not only assaulted his wife, but assaulted his mistress. He's right now, I think, a little bit ahead in the polls. And I don't know who the Democratic candidate is in Missouri, but if I were the Democratic campaign committee, I'd make sure that guy or that woman is well prepared, because Eric Greitens, even in a deep red state like Missouri, is potentially vulnerable.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. When you read what he's been accused of, it's not only sickening and criminal. He's a pervert.
Yeah.
But I guess being a pervert fits right into that political party. See, Lauren Boebert's husband. I don't know, but you're right. And I hope we get somebody who can do more than fog a mirror. But if he wins, you know, Claire McCaskill won a Senate seat in Missouri, and wasn't that long ago. It's a very tough state, but you can go too far even in Missouri.
Yeah, I wish that guy who ran against Roy Blunt who was the guy who ran against Roy Blunt? Really attractive young veteran. I can't remember his name.
I know who you're talking about. He was a great guy. He was a roommate of Mike Sherman's, who you know is helped me teach my class in Tulane.
Right,
and
right.
I'm hitting a blank wall.
Right, I am too. So what happens when you get to be our age, James?
A lot of blank walls.
One final wrap-up on this, and that is there were a number of contests in the Democratic House races yesterday between the left and the mainstream, if you will, and it was kind of divided. In North Carolina, the left suffered two defeats in congressional races. Pennsylvania, there's a race out there and near Pittsburgh where it's really very nip and tuck between a justice Democrat, Sumner Lee. I think she'll probably be a squad member if she wins, but it hadn't been decided the last time I checked. The one place that the establishment, the moderate, whatever have you lost, was in Oregon. But that was Kurt Schrader. Now, Kurt Schrader was an incumbent congressman, but he has been in absolutely in the tank to Big Pharma. He is opposed to any kind of action against high drug prices, Medicare negotiating drug prices. And you know something? That becomes to me much less of a left moderate fight than any Democratic congressman who wants to support Big Pharma ought to be in trouble.
I couldn't agree more. And I am hardly a Justice Democrat, but for the life of me, can't understand the reason why we can't negotiate, the government can't negotiate drug prices with Big Pharma. Of course, I know the reason. And Kurt Schrader knows the reason. It simply has to do with campaign donations and things like that. So I always people say, well, you're a moderate Democrat. I'm no such thing. I'm a liberal Democrat. Mm-hmm. And that's a bridge too far. That's a real bridge too far. I mean, that's just got your wrong priorities in order. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it really is. We are joined now by those celebrated authors, Jonathan Martin and Alexander Burns. Let me ask you both. This is a much-discussed book. There are great anecdotes about Trump, about McCarthy and Biden. What is the overarching theme, either one of you?
Al, I think it's an account of 2 years of political crisis in America told through the highest levels of both political parties. We go inside the room, we get on the conference calls, and we capture the struggle to, first to sort of make the democratic system work and ensure a peaceful transfer of power, which, of course, as we know, did not work on January 6th. And then we sort of capture the aftermath of the 6th in both parties and how it has shaped both parties. And it's also, Al, I would just add, it's the first book on the Biden presidency, too. And we go deep on his efforts to try to heal the country and unify his own fractious party with some, halting success.
Let me, there's a lot of attention to the Kevin McCarthy duplicity after January 6th. You have him on tape, and so you caught him lying, outright lying. But you don't have him on tape, but isn't Mitch McConnell, wasn't he almost as culpable in those perilous times in December and the first few days in January? I mean, he seemed to me to be just as disingenuous back then. Those were the crucial times as Kevin McCarthy. Alex?
Well, right. I mean, I think that the what you described as McCarthy's duplicity really comes immediately after January 6th. But of course, the duplicity of sort of the Republican establishment as a whole comes between Election Day and the certification vote, when they all see what Trump's doing. They all see that it's dangerous. Almost all of them believe in their hearts that it's bogus, and they say so in private, and they don't say so in public, right? We have this scene in the book in early December before the Electoral College votes, where Trump calls Mitch McConnell while he's in a meeting of Republican Senate leaders. And the president is just on this tear. It's very familiar to what people have heard from what people have heard in public about how Brian Kemp is so terrible. He needs to overturn the results in Georgia. And then he goes further and says, if we can get Kemp to overturn Georgia, then I've got Republicans in Michigan and Pennsylvania who are willing to do the same thing. And McConnell hangs up the phone. He takes off his glasses. He rubs his eyes and says, we got to stay focused on Georgia. But when he says Georgia, he means the Senate runoff elections there. He's not saying that they need to do something about Trump's efforts to overturn the election. The decision to put the sort of raw electoral politics over dealing head on with this emerging political crisis of the president's own making, obviously a choice with some very, very dire consequences.
Yeah, he really did. He put his political interest ahead of country. If that stolen election might not have gained as much currency, it's so dangerous to democracy if people like McConnell and Blunt had stood up in December. And I want to ask you both, too, if McConnell, after the Georgia 5th Georgia runoff where he lost, if he'd shown some guts on Trump impeachment, he could have gotten 70 votes and maybe gotten rid of this great menace.
Al, it's one of the great what-ifs in modern American history. What if McConnell had gone home the night of the 6th and started whipping his conference and gotten 20 Republicans? And look, if you do the math, you can find enough between people who were retiring in 22 and those who were unlikely to run again in 24 or 26, along with the usual suspects who are more moderates. But it would have taken leadership, and it would have taken McConnell to have sort of, really spent some capital to try to excise Trump once and for all. But as the days went on, McConnell, I think, was just taking the temperature of his conference and basically bowed to them instead of trying to lead them.
Yeah. Boy, what might have been? James Carville.
So, Alexander, I'll go to you first. I've just been scrolling through the George Packer review of you and Jonathan's book. And Packer makes what I think is a very legitimate point. This is not a campaign book. This is really a history book. And as I understand it, when I had lunch with y'all earlier, and you seem to be on the path of writing a campaign book, and you've transitioned into something bigger. Can you just give us a little chronology of how y'all made the decision to do this incompetent book, which George Packer is, frankly, one of the best modern observers of American culture and politics there is. And please read this review in Atlantic. But go ahead. Let's talk about the transition from another campaign book to a real first take of history on staggering.
Sure. No, that was a very, very gratifying a piece to read from George Packer, who we both have a lot of respect for. And look, what you just said is what we sort of I think we always hoped that even if we wrote a campaign book, in air quotes, that it would be a campaign book that would stand the test of time, that it wouldn't just be about staff rivalries and ad buys in this market or that market, stuff that's interesting to like the folks in this conversation, but that is ultimately pretty perishable. Look, I think that it was a gradual process. I think when COVID struck, we understood this was not going to be a normal campaign, that the backdrop for this was going to be much more dire, and that we weren't going to get, at least on the Democratic side, because of the health precautions that Biden was taking, we weren't going to get the high drama of the campaign trail the way political reporters often do. Look, I think the murder of George Floyd, Trump's refusal to concede defeat in the election, then ultimately January 6th, is just this cascade of events that told us over and over, you got to go broader and bigger than this. This cannot be a book that ends on Election Day, because the story of this political crisis didn't end on Election Day. In fact, the outcome on Election Day was, in so many ways, just an accelerant for the crisis of Trump's creation that happened in the weeks and months after that. And James, the last thing I'll just say, and I think this was an important piece of the George Packer review, and I think that you recognize this pretty clearly. I think the first year of the Biden administration is a really, really crucial element of this story, that if we were to tell the story of the political crisis of the last few years and end it with Joe Biden raising his right hand on January 20th, like, boy, does it miss the point of just how rocky things have been and continue to be for the country.
So Jonathan, one of the things that some Democrats feel, they like President Biden, but they think sometimes he takes the path of least resistance. I think you could see that, and I think one of the more interesting parts of your book from a Democratic standpoint was the selection of then-Senator Harris to be the vice presidential candidate. Can you distill and take us through this story? Because I think there's a lot we can learn a lot from that.
No, I think it's an important reveal about Biden's approach to major decisions. And there was no real uncertainty about how this was presented to us as we reported the book. The Biden inner circle found Senator Harris, then Senator Harris, to be effectively the safest pick. The closest thing there was to a do-no-harm pick for, very candidly, political purposes. They weren't considering governance. They weren't considering the succession, James, of the Democratic standard bearer in 2024 or 2028. They were thinking in sort of raw, immediate terms. How do we get Donald Trump out of the White House, and who can help us in that cause the best, or at least be the least, of the sort of not so great, the sort of least worst of the not so great options? And in that moment, I think there was consensus that she made the most sense. There was never a deep relationship between her and Biden. If anything, there was a bit of estrangement because of how she attacked Biden in that first debate. We report in the book that Jill Biden was deeply uneasy about picking Kamala Harris because of what she saw Kamala Harris do to her husband. And I think to this day, the Biden inner circle has never sort of fully embrace the political future of Kamala Harris. It's not like she was sort of welcomed into the Biden inner circle and tapped as the heir apparent. That has not happened. I think you see that today in their relationship, James.
Yes, I want to, in a little bit of defense, I'm going to turn it over to Al. Remember, it's Abraham Lincoln that picked Andrew Johnson and to win the election, and Kennedy picked Lyndon Johnson hardly because they had a warm relationship. We thought the path of, the way to win the election. But
that's
I
right.
think that reveals, that story reveals a ongoing strategy of don't do too much too controversial within the party. Just go along and get along as best you can. And
don't make hard decisions and basically don't take sides with either faction of the party. And you see that throughout the first year of his presidency. He never wants to fully be a part of the moderate wing or the progressive wing. He wants to have a foot in both camps. And obviously, when you try to do that, you can keep harmony for a while, but eventually it creates challenges.
Yes. Now, turn back to, I'll just make the observation is that if you always take the path of least resistance, sometimes I agree with making political decisions. I have no problem with that. But if that's all you guided with, and everybody knows that, they're all putting heat on you. But anyway, back to you, Al.
Jonathan, I think the turning point, perhaps even more than the legislative stuff for Biden's popularity, was the Afghanistan fiasco. And you are right that he blamed that on his advisors. Which ones?
I think he was not happy with any of his senior advisors, including Secretary of State Tony Blinken and Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor. He believes sort of he was given information that proved not to be accurate about the nature of the withdrawal. They did not clearly expect to have the kind of a messy and really historically damaging images coming out of the American withdrawal from Afghanistan. And I think you're right that you can sort of look at that point last August and sort of start tracing Biden's decline. It's not strictly about Afghanistan. It's about Biden's image and his competence and his ability to sort of, run the ship of state. And I think at that point, there's really certain questions begin about Biden's ability to govern, and he's never fully recovered, Al.
Alex, you didn't say this directly, but I get the impression from reading this book that you all don't think that this White House staff is quite up to prime time or major league ready. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I think there are certainly elements of the White House staff that's very sort of impressively credentialed and sort of well studied in the ways of Washington in different respects. I think what clearly is missing from the White House staff is, and this is, look, it'd be easy for us to sit here and say the White House staff is mediocre. They're not sort of Olympic class players. And I think that in some respects that would be true. In some respects, it would be really underselling the credentials and experience of some of the people closest to Biden. What's missing is a sense of urgency and direction and decisiveness from the president. More than anything else, right? I think, we depict in the book how there are different factions in the White House. There are people who are more moderate. There are people who are more ideological. There are people who are more focused on the Senate, people who are more focused on the House. And you know what? That's the story of basically every White House. But what's missing here is somebody at the center of the picture who will say, Ron Klain, I know that you get along with the Progressive Caucus and that you and Pramila Jayapal have this sort of channel where you're talking about going big on Build Back Better. Steve Ricchetti, I know that you get along with the moderate Democrats and Mark Warner and Susan Collins on the Republican side. But here's my agenda. And these are the boundaries of what we're going to try to do. And these are the trade-offs that we're going to execute. And look, I think staff could have served Biden better at a number of junctures. I think particularly the lack of sort of deep familiarity with the House among the people who are closest to Biden was a real handicap at some pretty important junctures. But in the big picture here, like the responsibility has to rest with the president.
Well, I know. I totally agree with you. I also think, however,
Add, if I could real fast, we have a scene in the book in the fall of 21 where Biden goes to the Capitol to address the House Democratic Caucus. And Nancy Pelosi and a number of lawmakers in the House are expecting Biden to say point blank to the progressives, I need your vote today, or at least this week. To pass the infrastructure bill. And you have my word, we'll also pass Build Back Better, but I need your vote on both. And we got to do infrastructure. And Biden never says point blank that I need your vote directly. And so Pelosi, who is, you know, privately horrified by Biden's refusal to sort of say it out loud, has to say it herself. But it's not the same as the president of the United States urging his own party for a vote. And in fact, you know, Biden, classic Biden mode, is telling stories, and he has this anecdote about Satchel Paige that he just leaves House Democrats looking at each other, sort of wondering, what does he want us to do? And I think that gets to the heart of what Alex is saying. Ultimately, this is on Biden.
It all ultimately comes to the president in every administration. He also doesn't have anybody who's a peer. There is no peer there. They're all staff people, and they're good staff people, as you say, well-credentialed. But most good presidents have a peer or two. Let me ask you a final question, then turn it over to James. You write about the dysfunction and the problems of both parties, and it's certainly true. But isn't that a bit of a false equivalency? I mean, the Democrats have ideological divides. They have confidence divide. The Republicans are embracing dangerous stuff. A lie about a stolen election, refusing to stand up to a mob assault on the Capitol, really threats to democracy. And while both parties are screwed up, the Republicans are far more dangerous. Either one of them.
I mean, Al, I think that we say very much, we say things that are very similar to that in the book. I don't think it's a false equivalency at all. Look, we have one political party that is in thrall to a dangerous demagogue who's attacking the roots of the democratic system. We write that. We don't pull any punches on just how dangerous the drift of the Republican Party is in that direction. But we also felt really strongly coming into this that if the story that we tell ourselves sort of as a country and certainly as a press corps of the last few years is that American politics is in a pretty bad place because of Donald Trump and the Republican Party, that would be a pretty narrow and simplistic tale as well, because you do need to have, ideally, you would have two parties in the country that were relatively coherent, basically serious about government, understood their own coalitions and priorities, and when they had power, were actually able to execute on some of it. Right now, we don't have any party that fits that description, and that's a danger to democracy, too.
James.
Okay, I respect your time, so I'm going to go to you, Alexander, and finish with you, Jonathan. This is the question. How close did we come to blowing a gasket on January 6th to 2021? Was there a point where this thing could have gone just horribly?
It went pretty badly, but as we say in the book, it could have gone so much worse if they had not evacuated the members quickly enough. If Mike Pence or Nancy Pelosi had been caught by a rampaging mob, it could have been orders of magnitude more dangerous for the country. And I will say, James, this is not something that we really say in the book, but you know, there are other countries where, in a scenario where you had the incumbent president having been defeated but refusing to leave office, and you had basically the entire legislature sequestered in secure locations and military bases, somebody with a uniform would have gotten some ideas about the opportunity in front of them. And so I'm not saying that I think we came very close to like a 7 days in May situation, but I think we're really, really fortunate that the political culture and the military culture of this country didn't make that an easier thing for somebody to contemplate.
Jonathan, do you have anything you want to add?
I think what saved us is the individual choices of individuals. Alex mentioned sort of military, the leadership, and obviously a lot of people were silent, but there were some in the military who, of course, were not going to sort of let the country's democracy collapse. And I think, you know, Mike Pence could have made a very different decision on January 6th. If Mike Pence bows to Trump's pressure and, you know, even delays the ratification of the Electoral College, that would have created a constitutional crisis, you know, basically 10 days before Biden was to be sworn in as the next president. And that would have taken us to really unprecedented territory in modern American history. So I think it could have been a lot worse, both constitutionally and in terms of the physical threat to lawmakers in the Capitol itself. But we were close. I mean, I think we were minutes, if not seconds, away. And I think if not for the lawmakers being evacuated out of the Capitol building itself into the tunnels, I think you could have seen a lot more bloodshed. It's sobering to think about, and we devote an entire chapter to the day of the 6th, but it could have been a lot worse, James.
Well, thank y'all. I really want to respect your time. Y'all respected us by coming on the show. This book is going to go down as one of the better history books of this century, and I think historians are going to be mining this book a long time as they write the inevitable 6,000 books on January the 6th. But let me give y'all credit. This is a superb book. Read George Packer's interview, and this will tell you more than you've ever known before. So thank y'all both.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Okay, James, now for the questions from these really, really smart, caring listeners that we have. Tony, in rural area near Auckland, New Zealand. Man, that's the one country I haven't been to that I really want to get to someday.
Oh, me too.
It's so beautiful. Now, Tony, listen, this is good. Tony's been tapped to run for, I think it's called the Waiuku Local Board under the Labour Party. His district is a pretty conservative one. Its equivalency would be like, he says, Virginia, how they flip from one party to the next. Even though this is a minor election, how do I go forward in an effective local election addressing the needs of the community within a pretty conservative district?
Well, this is a problem that a lot of people face in politics around the world, where they may not ideologically align with the majority of the district. What people are generally looking for is to tell people that you understand the district. And when you do that, you have to be as granular as you possibly can. You have to use, you know, symbolism and people in the district. You got to pick things that you can do and advocate that would be good for people as a whole. But you want to position yourself as the kind of can-do guy and who's willing to get things done, and let them try to paint this in a more ideological way. But you painted more, I'm here to help people as opposed to helping a particular ideology. That's a pretty standard way to run, and it's actually about as good as any you can where you have some ideological mismatch with the people that are voting for you.
Good advice, Tony. And please write us and let us know the outcome. How'd you fare? The next question is from Jonathan in Arlington, Virginia, right next door to me. He says, hey, you know, why don't Schumer and McConnell meet and agree to weaken the voices of the extremes, AOC, Gosar, Jordan, Omar, et cetera? I'm not even wondering about primary challenges. Just relegate them as much as possible. Seems like it would benefit both of them and their parties. Jonathan, I really think you're off the mark on this. Number one, there's a great imbalance here. Yes, Schumer and Pelosi have some fringes, but they are such a small contingent compared to the fringes that face not only Kevin McCarthy, but also Mitch McConnell. I would just remind you of Josh Hawley and Tom Cotton and the like. But the second point is, there isn't a whole lot you can do to minimize the so-called extremes in a legislative body. You can't take them off committees unless there's someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene. They have their vote and they have their voice. So I empathize with your desire here, Jonathan, but it's just not very achievable. Also, McConnell and Schumer barely speak to each other.
But this is one of the, my kind of things that I'll take a look at on this. So people will come to me and say, well, James, you know, we got our crazies and, you know, you got your crazies, you know, and you know, we need some kind of political party that'll just meet in the middle. Yeah, we do have some people that are, I don't know, crazy, but we have some people that are impractical, I think, naive and silly. And according to the Pew poll, it's 11% of the country. Over one quarter of their caucus is now siding with a hostile foreign power. That's not naive. That's not silly. That's evil. And this is my example I'll give to everybody. I'll give it to our listeners and our questioner. If you had a daughter, a granddaughter, a grandson, a nephew, a niece, whatever, and they came up and they said, I want to tell you, I got a job. I'm assistant research analyst in the office of Congressman AOC. Your probable reaction would be what mine would be. Well, you know, that's going to be a good experience, honey. I'll be probably going to run into many different people. But some of the things that your boss believes in, I think, are impractical or naive. But, you know, have fun, and you're going to meet a lot of interesting different people. I think that would be most people's reaction. On the other hand, your daughter, grandson, niece, nephew, whatever comes up and says, people, I'm so excited. I just got a job as a research assistant in Marjorie Taylor Greene's office. At that point, you go to the highest building you can get to and jump immediately because your life is over, okay? You're done. You're a gigantic failure as a mentor, as a parent, as whatever it is that you are. They are. AOC and Marjorie Taylor Greene are not remotely comparable in their extremism, patriotism, or anything else. That's an easy pit to fall into because it makes so much sense until you stop and think about it. And again, there's much less of them, and none of them that I know are particularly evil people at all. I think they're naive, but that's okay. I think some of the stuff, this language obsession is more or less silly, but it's also, for the most part, harmless. Russia is neither silly or harmless at all.
Well, James, that leads...
So we shouldn't conflate the two.
That really leads to our next question, because it really is a good one. I also would say, by the way, a former student of mine from Penn is AOC's communications director, and she is one impressive and accomplished woman. I don't agree with AOC in some things, but I got to tell you, when people like that really are valuable public servants, and your distinction is absolutely right on. Bill in New Orleans, this picks up on what you've been talking about, wants to know, with the public heavily in favor of aiding Ukraine, why doesn't Biden spend more time communicating the serious and coordinated U.S. efforts and contrast that with Trump and his general infatuation with Putin and his statements praising autocrats?
So I'm not a foreign policy person. You obviously have a great deal of experience in reporting on it and being around it. I think Biden's got to be a little bit careful as to how far out there he is, because the Western Europe response has really been gratifying in this. And I think if he made it too much of an American-led, inspired effort, that would not help these politicians and governments in Europe who are coming around, for the most part, doing the right thing here. And I don't think he should lead from behind. I don't know, but I'm not saying if he leads from ahead, it shouldn't be from very far ahead. He has to keep his partners. He has to keep the people that are helping with this in line and part of a coalition, because if you do what most people believe, this is going to be a pretty long slog, and we got to keep people on board. And these, our Western European partners and other countries like, say, Japan and other people that are, you know, obviously Australia and New Zealand, who are with us, we got to keep them in a coalition. I'm very disappointed in India. I'm particularly disappointed in Israel. They're taking a hands-off kind of view of the whole thing. Like, well, what did Russia, the Soviet Union, have to do with the creation of Israel? It was the United States, Harry Truman, that did that. And I love the Israeli country, but I I'm not very pleased with their government right now.
Well, I agree with you. James, you probably have followed this more closely than I have. My impression is they were awful in the beginning, and they've gotten a little bit better. And maybe that's wrong. Maybe they've stayed bad.
Maybe.
Anyway.
They should be really good.
Absolutely, they should.
Where's the Iron Dome come from?
It's about democracy. That's what, I mean, Israel loves to point out correctly that in that troubled region, they are the one true democracy. And so if they want to choose between Ukraine democracy and Russian autocracy, that should be an easy choice. The next question is Beverly in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. You know, I was a director of a bunch of community newspapers at Dow Jones, and I always hoped that they would name me the editor of the Cape Cod Times. I always wanted to live up there and work. It's a great place in the winter as well as the summer. Beverly says national laws, gun laws, don't seem possible. Do you think some moderate programs at state levels could work? Well, you have those, Beverly, but the problem is this Supreme Court may be about to gut some of those. and so, therefore, it's pretty hard to say, well, I mean, see, this Supreme Court believes in state supremacy unless it's something that doesn't fit their ideological agenda. So they have a big gun case coming up probably next month. And, Beverly, I suspect you and I are going to be disappointed.
I think the gun case comes out of New York State, and they're challenging the sort of concealed weapons. So let me get this straight. Not they're going to say, if they go the way they always go, I think they're going to say you can't pass a law telling somebody they can't carry a concealed weapon. Boy, I really want to walk into a bar or an athletic contest with people with packing heat. That's going to end very well now, isn't it? And again, the progressive advocacy groups in Washington, I'm sorry, and the gun control people I put in there have basically been pathetically ineffective. I put women reproductive health organizations and environmental groups and people that want to fight climate change. I think that all of us who believe that there's such a thing as reasonable gun legislation and that guns are a big problem, all of us who think that this climate is a just gut-wrenching, awful problem, all of us who think that draconian methods of controlling women are odious to anything we have in modern America, I think that all of us have been in some ways let down by the leadership of these kind of groups in Washington. I really do. And I've been in my so for a long time.
Let's hope they're listening to you and start to turn around. You know, James, this next question is worth it, even though it picks up on some stuff we've already talked about, just for the life experiences of the questioner. Doug. Doug is writing from Spain via Kiev and Jacksonville, Florida. Now, Doug is a guy that has been around. So he asks, are there any races you can think of, I mean, we were talking about this a minute ago, where the Republican candidate is pro-Russian or against assisting Ukraine, I can make calls for the opponents. I mean, which candidates can we identify? Can we at this stage?
Rand Paul?
Yep.
Who's actually on the ballot. Booker got the Democratic nomination, I'll be honest with you. It's Kentucky, but, you know, 57 different House members. I got to see which one of them are running. You know, good research. But there is a huge pro-Russian sentiment in the Republican Party, led by, whatever you want to say, Tucker Carlson's probably the most powerful person in the Republican Party, is out front pro-Russian. Out front. So,
Doug, I tell
there's
you,
everybody. I don't know how people are not even more outraged.
Doug, I tell you what you can do. Check two sources, the Cook Political Report or the Rothenberg Political Report. It's not called Rothenberg anymore, but you can look it up and get what it is. And look at the races that they call toss-up or lean Republican. And then cross-reference that with those 57 Republicans who voted against aid to Ukraine in the House. And if any are in there, then you can go and you can make calls for their opponents. James Marty in Perth, Australia. Man, we're doing great in Australia and New Zealand today, aren't we?
Where's Marty from, Al?
He's from Perth, Australia.
Oh, Perth. Oh, okay. Well, that's extreme. I've never been. I always wanted to go. It's way out and face the Indian Ocean.
I haven't been to Australia. I know you have.
Thunder down under.
Sydney is great. Someone told me that the capital is not the most exotic place in the world in Australia.
It's Canberra. Yeah. It's like Brasilia. They just invented a city to have a capital.
But, you know, Ambassador Caroline Kennedy is going to brighten it up when she gets there. Marty in Perth, Australia says, if Chief Justice Roberts is really concerned about the reputation of the court, do you think he would internally threaten to resign or actually resign his seat to protest at the conservative politicalization of the court? John Roberts is a profile in courage. There is no chance in the world of that happening, Marty. I do think the chief is concerned about the reputation of the court. He ought to be. This court is held in lower standing at any time in modern memory, but I don't think there's any chance there's going to be a resignation. But I don't think there's much he can do about it.
Well, this is something that, as we go to November, people say, and I think I'll be the historian here, but that efforts to run against the court or make the court a big issue in presidential campaigns generally not had a great effect. It probably has some effect on turnout that favors the Republicans a little bit. But all of this has transpired when the court had a, 65, 70, 75% approval. Now it's way underwater. It's made itself vulnerable to attack. And I'm sorry that how could a Supreme Court justice think that the Supreme Court can't be criticized? Of course it can't. In part, is there a lot to criticize in addition to just throwing any kind of precedent out of the door? Ethically, they're all challenged. They're guided by no rules. They do everything on a shadow document. They do whatever they want to without any regard. And I'm serious. If I'm a municipal court judge in Bunky, Louisiana, I'm a little bit, why should I follow any ethical rules when the goddamn Supreme Court doesn't have any? And that's the kind of logic you can see coming up time and time again. They are getting a terrible reputation because they really worked hard to get this reputation. I mean, this has been an all-out effort on behalf of people like Clarence Thomas to degrade the court.
With a big assist from Mitch McConnell.
Yes.
Finally, Linda in South Lake Tahoe, California. There are some pretty cool places that are people are writing from. She says, what the hell is wrong with Merrick Garland? Why hasn't the DOJ brought charges against Donald Trump? How much longer do we have to wait?
Maybe not as long as you think. And I was a Merrick Garland skeptic early on. I can't tell you that I'm a Merrick Garland, enthusiastic supporter, but my skepticism is lessening by the day. I think he's a very methodical man. I think he will, he's not going to do anything unless he's accumulated all the facts, which is probably an attribute in attorney general. But he's already requested the January 6th committee turn over certain testimony to him. And, I wouldn't be surprised if you turn on somebody calls you at 8:30 one morning and says, you're not going to believe this shit, how many people he indicted. I don't know that that's going to happen, but I think the guy is like plowing and harrowing his field, and he might be planting something. We might see something here. I don't know that, but whatever he does, it's going to be methodical, and it's going to be in all likelihood very meritorious.
Yeah, sure will be. Okay, Linda, stay tuned because there may be big news coming up in the next couple of weeks. Some of this, is going to play out in conjunction with the January 6th committee investigations. And there's always, when a congressional investigation is going on and a potential criminal investigation going on in the Justice Department, they're going to have to work out arrangements as to what goes first and what priorities are. But I agree. And I'll tell you something. Our dear friend, the late Walter Dellinger, will be pleased to know, James, that you have tempered your views of his friend Merrick Garland.
Well, that has something to do with Walter. And it's a little more understanding. I've tempered it. I would put myself in the enthusiastic camp, but I'd say I'm willing, to see that he's got something. And by the way, these January 6th hearings are coming up soon, and I don't know, but I'm going to be surprised if they're not going to be pretty explosive.
They're going to be in prime time, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
And boy, you know, of course, events around the world, it might be the third story by the time we get through it, yeah, everything else.
Yeah, who knows? All righty. We love those questions, so please keep them coming. Now for the outrage of the week. Hey, James, let's understand. The problems with this Republican Supreme Court extend well beyond abortion. This week, the six conservative justices further gutted campaign finance law by removing any ceiling on what a candidate can raise after an election to pay off a personal loan. No issue of corruption, these justices said, none of whom ever has run in a campaign. Of course, these same conservatives say donors during a campaign give primarily out of belief, not to curry a favor. But after, to pay off the winning candidate's personal loan? Well, Justice Elena Kagan explained to her colleagues why. A winning candidate can return the favor with a vote, a contract, an appointment. It's an I'll make you richer and you'll make me richer. It really is an outrageous decision. And then Justice Clarence Thomas. I don't know who's angry. We have a vote sometimes with our listeners, James. Who's angrier, Clarence Thomas or Samuel Alito? Well, and of course, he may be not as angry as his unhinged wife. But he blasted the liberals for trashing conservative justice nominees, something he said conservatives don't do. Oh, really, Mr. Justice? You must have missed those Senate Judiciary Committee hearings on Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, when she was accused of supporting pedophilia, asked about her religion, how she defines a woman. Is that just good high-level chatter, Mr. Thomas?
Well, and if you think this is outrageous, just wait till some of these new decisions that come down are going to be increasingly more outrageous. And if you ever could think of something that would foster corruption more than me going to a donor after the election that I've won, and getting a donation and putting it in my pocket.
To repay your personal, yeah, exactly.
Right.
Right.
You can't imagine how bad a public policy this is. But in terms of horrific public policy, stand by. You know, you've seen Shelby County, you've seen the draft of the Dobbs decision, you've seen a lot of stuff. Hang on, because it's going to get worse. It's bad, and it's going to get worse. My outrage is, by any observation that you have, Russia is easily described as a hostile foreign power. I mean, I don't know how you could deny it. They've interfered in our elections. They've hacked into our computers. They have attacked us about every way that you can. They don't allow free speech. They jail dissidents. And then they hold off without provocation or reason to decide to invade a country that was zero threat to them. In this past week, the 57 House Republicans, which is more than one quarter of the House Republican Congress, voted with a hostile foreign power. Now, when we were kids growing up, if somebody was with Axe or Sally or Tokyo Rose, they'd have probably been shot. And the Republican Party has become one of the most anti-patriotic groups in the United States. I don't know any other way to say it. It's totally befuddling to me in ways that we couldn't imagine that are very gratifying. That Western Europe has rallied to the support of Ukraine. Western Europe is working with us, Finland and Sweden, it's a huge deal, applying to NATO, and over one quarter of the elected Republican House members are siding with a hostile foreign power. That is an historic outrage.
Boy, it sure is. Sure is. Okay, please send us more suggestions for our outrages as well as the questions. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Raycon and Chili Sleep, in the show notes. We really thank you for supporting them. When you do, it helps make this podcast happen. To keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. Please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.